You know, there's a new recovery group emerging. Our society has many self-help groups and recovery groups. Some say it's because we have been displaced as a extended family nation and become more of a nuclear family nation, and even that has been reduced in size to single mothers, single people's homes. And so we have support groups in a way to try to compensate for that, and that's one reason why they're so popular and the need. And this particular support group is a recovery process from being under the power of transnational capitalist class corporations. Absurd, isn't it? Recovery group for that. But anyway, I have their first two principles as that group's evolving, so you can tell who might be starting that group. We have come to the awareness that we are oppressed, dislodged, and displaced from our true selves. The structure of our society facilitates a false self so that we can participate in this society. This morning, and a false self is an interesting concept because you can be a false self and know you're being a false self and let that go and come back and be your true self, or you can actually merge into your false self and that's all you know about yourself. For example, we stopped to get gas this morning, and I went into the place, and usually when I go into this particular gas station, Fox News is blaring, right? So I avoid it as much as possible. And but this morning it was off. So I said to the person behind the counter, I said, "Thank God that that's off." And she smiled and she said, "Yeah, he's gone away for a week." So I thought, oh, maybe you could sue for political harassment or form a union, you know. But then I was reminded of that story from the book that we had gone through and had some sermons on, if you'll remember, called The Dark Mother, tracing the displacement of indigenous peoples by patriarchy and imperialist nations, and that what would happen, and there's a story about this town in France, that when the church leaders would come through, the people would parade through with big crosses and everything that pleased the church leaders, and naturally so, because the consequences were quite severe if you did not do that. But as soon as they were left and over the hill, the people would come out and they would bring the statue of Madonna, which was a dark statue of Madonna connecting back to the Dark Mother, and they would have their party and festival that was truly who they were. So they became a false self so they wouldn't be persecuted. But when the persecution and the oppression was gone, they'd go back to who they truly are. The danger is, again, is when the false self becomes the only sense of self. And generally, the more severe the persecution is, the more severe the oppression is, the more intense the false self is, and you learn to let go of your true self. My hunch is, in this room, we don't have a lot of people who conform. And we have a lot of people that challenge. If I asked you to be a particular way on a Sunday morning, you would not come back, or you would choose to be the other way just on purpose to show me that you wouldn't have to be that particular way. I mean, I do it. We do it. It's a reaction formation. You're not going to tell me what to do and what to believe. So, as we begin this idea, know your place. Really, the only way to get at that, and I thought of many ways of beginning to present this kind of idea, but I think the first realization is to know we have been displaced. I was going to use the word, and obviously since I'm going to say it, I'm going to use it, and Helen and I had some discussion about it. We're deranged. gee, well, that might be a bit strong. We might not want to use that word deranged. But then after thinking about it, she said, the human being in its 100,000 year history has a sense of territory, has a sense of place, has a sense of tribe, has a sense of belonging. And in that sense of territory, and we've talked some about this before, you might walk around your neighborhood and in a sense you're claiming your territory. That's your neighborhood, even if it's not your yard and you don't own it, or you're not borrowing it from the bank, however you want to understand that. You know, if something happens, you know, 100 yards from your house that's kind of out of place, you have a feeling about it, because that's your territory. But yet at the same time, like at our house, the lot next door to us is, you know, I thought about how to say this, it's undeveloped. You know, the it's more in its natural state, but I want to say it's undeveloped. Like, that's the problem. It's not developed. Even that language is a problem. But it's all treed. You know, and Brazilian peppers, which are amazing things, Brazilian peppers. I was out there this morning, and all the pollen, just heard it. It was just good or bad. It was just amazing. Somebody could come along tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and how they usually do that is they put two little marks on the street and just wipe out everything on that line. My psyche and my being of what it means to be human, that's territory. That's part of me. I'm just not this flesh thing. I have a spirit that moves out. That's territory, and it's part of who I am. And when that just gets cleared, I am deranged. My range is gone. I have no power, no say where my range is. It's a problem. I am displaced. My sense of being, my sense of belonging disappears. And there's this saying in the book we've gone through before, Stories About Buddha, and talking about sacred scriptures and how much power scriptures have in our culture, and it played in our history, and good and bad. It's called, the sacred scriptures taught that happiness was the ability to accept one's position. Accept your position. In a minute, I'll tell you what society that comes from. So we're displaced, and when we look at that, we try to understand it. Christopher Lash, a social historian, wrote the book, The Culture of Narcissism, that we live in a culture of narcissism, and we're addicted to the feeling of acquisition. We're not addicted to actually the object. We're addicted to the process of acquiring the object. So we acquire the object and we let it go, and we're on off to acquire another object. Ann Wilson writes the book, The Addictive Society, that our society is just an addictive process and we can never be at rest and we can never feel at home. And it talks about anxiety and depression being normalized in our culture. Rather than changing the culture so that we can let the anxiety and depression go, we create a pharmaceutical industry so that we don't have to change our culture because it benefits a few. So we create a pharmaceutical industry that numbs us out so we don't have to deal with the issues that cause us anxiety and depression, because we're powerless to do so anyway. Something like that. In the codependent field, 96% of the people are codependent. Codependent basically means you will sacrifice yourself to the other, not taking care of yourself. Are we a nation of healthy, vibrant, alive people? Or are we a nation that's fearful? Are we a nation that says, as liberal, moderate people say, you know, from 1945, after World War II and the Roosevelt administration, to the 1970s, we had a strong, vibrant middle class and was really good. We had pensions. We were taking care of the elderly. We were taking care of people that were poor, and we developed ladders for people that were poor through the educational process, that they could actually move through education to the better of their life, and they had equal opportunity. And for those 30 or 40 years, it was really something. But now that which we call was really something is not just being threatened, It has largely been dismantled, and we live in fear that the rest will go soon. Codependent. Challis Glendening, a book we just read in the book group that we have. Hi, my name is Challis, and I'm in recovery from Western civilization. Her take on our culture is that we suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome as a culture because we are perpetually bombarded by messages that are not life-giving. We are just perpetually bombarded by information. Our lots next to us are perpetually cleared. Our commons, the common, are perpetually cleared and polluted and have toxics on them, and we live with that every day. Do we know our place? Have you been put in your place? Is your place to challenge that? Is your place to speak up against that? What is our place? And my favorite, Christopher Bolas, who coined the term the normotic personality, is an outcome of all these difficulties we struggle with. And the normotic personality is the personality that's excessively normal. There's a numbing of subjectivity in the person in favor of a self that is conceived as a material object among other man-made products in the objective world. Now, what does that mean? That a human being, our subjectivity is our thinking, our meaning-making, our reflecting, our capacity to read, and say, what is it that I just read? And how does what I just read make sense with what's going on over here? That happens in our subjectivity. So, and he's saying this normotic personality structure, that's becoming erased. And the person is becoming an object and a material object like other material objects in this world. When you look, I saw something the other day on television. Spitzer's first name? The guy from Elliot Spitzer. I don't know. He's got a new program out, and he was talking to a person that represented a particular political movement in our country, and the person that represented this particular political movement used the languages like liberty, freedom, small government, and those things, but then. Spitzer said, wait a minute, I'm a capitalist too, and we can't have this because if these things are too big to fail and they form a monopoly, you really can't have capitalism. And really gave some thought and some depth to the conversation. The other person repeated, if you're having a conversation with somebody and you say something and they say something back to you, you say something back to them and they say something back to you, and it's engaging, and you can tell that the conversation's gaining some depth and there's new information coming. And as you're talking to the person, they're accessing different parts of their history and different parts of their learning and different parts of their personal experience. And as you engage them, you're doing the same, and it really has meaning and you really feel good about the conversation, and it's very genuine and very real. And so this person offers these cliches, and Spitzer says, wait a minute, no, because of this, this, and this. And it comes back, and the person offers the exact same cliches. And Spitzer comes back and says, well, what about this, this? I mean, did it three or four different perspectives drilling in on this subject, and every time the person came back with the exact same cliches. Normotic personality, excessively normal, no operative subjectivity or critical thinking. And this was a significant leader of a political party. So he goes on further to say about this particular type of personality. We might say of the psychotic has shut him or herself up in the extreme depths and unconscious and symbols that have meaning, and there's no way to organize the symbolic meaning in the person's life, so they become psychotic and they apply meanings that don't necessarily match the external world, and that's the psychotic experience. But the normotic has shut him or herself up in an extremely superficial way. The unconscious is an anachronism. The unconscious is something that doesn't make sense anymore. And trying to understand the unconscious is abandoned in the pursuit of human progress. And you might remember the quote from Hannah Arendt a week ago, 2 weeks ago, where she did the interview and reporting on the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who organized the transportation of people going to the concentration camps in World War II. And what she was surprised when during that interview was she expected something really evil and something just horrible. And what she said was, all this man could do was give cliches when asked questions, give spin when asked questions. There was no depth. And what happened was that she realized what gives evil power is the lack of critical thinking. What gives evil power is surface thought. And so evil, like a fungus, can sweep a nation and take over a nation. And from that we learn that nations can be not reflective. Nations can be a group of people that no longer make meaning for themselves, that meaning is given to them. And when meaning is given to them, their place is given to them. Nina Simone. Do you have any know Nina Simone? Singer, wonderful, beautiful. Singer, just wonderful. She was gifted from the age of 3, they could tell. Gave her piano, took care of her. She had talents. They nurtured those talents. At 12, she was going to give her first public appearance, and her parents sat down in front. Now, Nina Simone's African American. Her parents were sitting down in front. This was mid 1950s or so, I think, or late 50s. And as the quotes say, as the Caucasian people were coming in, they asked her parents to go sit in the back to make way for the Caucasian people. And she said, well, I'm not playing unless my parents are sitting up front. So they gave in and moved her parents up front. She did not accept her place. She created her own place. That spirit in her did not shrink within. It stayed out there, which is a testimony to her home life, because her home life, by 12, didn't already teach her to shrink, but to be present for who she was as a person. And we'll get to an 11-year-old story in a minute that's different. And there's another story about this mother and this 11-year-old and this 8-year-old girl. They're out in the snow and they get on the bus, and the mother puts the little girl, she had her snow coat on, puts the little girl on the seat, and she's sitting next to a woman who had a fur coat. And so the woman who had the fur coat pulls up her coat, and the little girl says, I thought she pulled up her coat because there was something disgusting between us, like a roach or something. So I pulled up my coat because I didn't want whatever it was that was going to get on her to get on me. So she was sitting there and she's looking. She didn't see nothing. And she looked at the woman and then she realized I was the object of disgust. It was me. She was being put in her place. That woman was letting her know something. Put in her place. The story that some of you might be familiar with, Savasti in the life of Buddha. Savasti was 11 years old and he was tending the water buffalo. And in the water buffalo, he set him out to graze and he was taking a break and he walked in the woods and he sees Buddha meditating. And from Savasti's point of view, here's this beautiful man meditating. And Savasti starts to run up to him to to talk to him and to engage him. And so in his spontaneous spirit, he's moving toward something he considers beautiful and to engage this man. But then he stops himself. And he realizes, I'm an untouchable. I can't approach this man. So by 11, he knows his place. He knows who he is. And he stops himself. He no longer has to be told his place. He knows his place. For his father had taught him that in our society, the Brahma, the religious people, the priests, the teachers, they are the highest class. They are the highest caste. There's a second caste, and the second caste is the political and the military people. And then there's a third caste, the merchants, the farmers, the craftsmen. Then there's a fourth caste, the ones who do manual labor not performed by the higher castes. But in Savasti's family, the lowest of all, he's an untouchable. He cannot even live in the city. And if he touches somebody who is other than his class, other than his caste, he gets beaten. Physically beaten, physically punished. And so his father tells him, this is the way things are. And he studies the scriptures, and the scriptures teach him, the sacred scriptures taught that happiness is the ability to accept one's position in life. By 11, he had internalized his place. Now, you know, it's funny if you look at that list of castes. You got the myth makers, the priests, the teachers, those who make the myth that structures society. They're the top people. Then the political, then the military, then the merchant, the farmers, the craftsmen people. And do you remember, if you know, the conservative writer Edmund Burke? Some of you might be familiar with him. He's the one that said that the candle makers, and I believe it was the hairstylists, they should never have the vote. It'd be an unruly society if they ruled society, these craftspeople of the third rung here. And then you have the people who clean up in the city, and you have the people who live outside the city. You know what's curious about that? In Buddhism and in genuine Christianity and in democracy, that's completely done away with. Completely done away with. One person, one vote, you don't have a caste system. Who did Jesus serve? He served the poor. He served the people who were outside the city, the lepers. Who did Buddha engage? He engaged Savasti and made Savasti a monk eventually. So there are rebellious voices. In our society today, to know your place. At the University of Wisconsin, on a Friday night, there was a person who wore a t-shirt that says, "Legalize gay marriage." He was punched in the face. At Carthage College, and around that same time, there was a teen who committed suicide because he had experienced harassment at school. In Milwaukee, there were 5 teens who committed suicide because of bullying and harassment. There was another story of this 11-year-old boy who went to be a cheerleader. And his friends called him sissy, called him gay, beat him up, and broke his collarbone, broke his shoulder. All of these are behaviors that tell people where their place is. And they're violent acts telling people where their place is. Not just them, but those in the community around them. Don't you be like this, because if you're like this, this is what you'll get. This is your place. This is not your place. What struck me about the story about the cheerleader was that they thought it important in the article to say that he insisted it wasn't true. As if it were true, it would have been the right thing to do. It wasn't wrong just because it was wrong. He insisted that. So as we confront the processes in our culture that tell us our place, as we begin this conversation and trying a way of understanding who we are, it might be helpful for us to go back and look at our stories. And do you find places where your spirit moved you to participate, and then there was a voice in your head that said, you better step back. you better step back. Or you found yourself going to take a seat somewhere, and somebody said, that seat's not for you. You're not to sit there. Each of those places where we withdrew, where Nina Simone did not withdraw, but those places out of peer pressure, those places out of social impingement, which we withdrew, those places out of which we're presenting a joyous self to a parent and it gets rejected, those places that say, I want to study this, and that gets rejected, those places that say, these are my friends, and these other friends make fun of me, so I start making fun of those people along with them. All those places in our lives, and we live in a culture that will tell us our place. Let there be no doubt about that. And if we're in this culture, and I'm of this culture, I have been told my place. And sometimes I have been forthright and said no, and there have been times when I have taken a step back. All those places within us are places of woundedness. Are places that still hurt, possibly. That need attention. And for us to step out and claim our place, and for us to say, no, this is not my place. This is where I belong. This is what I'm going to be about. For me to make that decision on my own, I have to attend to that historical woundedness. To do that. Because it's still there. In the story of Nina Simone at 12 years old, what if she would not have spoke up, and what if she would have played that and with her parents in the back, and every time she was playing, she looked, there they would be in the back. I know in my own life experiences, those kind of events are like a spike of shame that drill into me when I remember them. And it hurts my soul. So I have to deal with that to be free of that, to come out and to engage this world. Do I know my place? We are taught in many ways our place. But hopefully, this is a place that says, can we bring healing to that woundedness? Can we rediscover those parts of ourselves we have discarded and have put aside because we felt there was no place for that part of me? Can we create a place where we can come together and allow that to come out, allow those parts to have expression, and find out who we fully are as we participate in recovery from Western civilization?